Inigo's Tenth Dream. The Poilus Theatre was halfway along Doulon Lane, in the Kobara district. There was no sign outside. It occupied the cellars underneath the toy shop, whose windows were full of brightly coloured wooden dolls and puppets. Entry was through a narrow doorway in a recess, formed by the angle between the toy shop and the neighbouring tanners. Two doormen in long, dark coats stood outside, stamping their feet on the pavement to keep warm in the chilly midnight air. Ediard and Christabel arrived as the clock in Renan Plaza chimed 15:15. When Ediard pushed his cloak's hood back, the doorman gave a start, then smiled.
"They told us you'd be coming," he said. "Welcome to the Poilus, Water Walker, mistress."
The door was opened, revealing curving stairs leading downwards. Warm air spilled up, accompanying a loud grumble of conversation and someone playing a guitar.
"He's about to start," the doorman added as Ediard led Christabel down.
It grew warmer with each step. Ediard could sense the excitement growing in Christabel's mind. She gave him a tentative smile as they reached the theatre itself. It was a broad vaulting chamber with side alcoves converted to bars. Iron-caged oil lamps on the walls complemented a small lighting strip at the apex of the ceiling. Ediard gave the glass bulbs a wary gaze. The far end of the cellar had a wooden stage, where the guitarist was struggling against the hearty voices of everyone crammed together on the main floor. Christabel took her coat off. Those nearest to her cast curious glances as they saw the pearl-encrusted blue silk gown she wore. Then Ediard shrugged out of his cloak, showing off his black and scarlet dress jacket with silver brocade and snow-white rough shirt. There were a great many surprised grins.
"Hee-hoo! The dandies have arrived!" Maxen called out loudly.
Christabel grinned and hugged Maxen. Then Dinlay appeared, shoving a drink at Ediard. Boyd was laughing delightedly in greeting. Soraya embraced Christabel. A merrily drunk Cancine gave Ediard a big kiss.
"What kept you?" Dinlay demanded.
He had his arm around the shoulders of a strapping girl, whose flaming red hair reached down to her waist. Ediard struggled to make no comment. Dinlay always seemed to wind up with girls at least as big as himself.
"It was a good party," Ediard said loyally.
Christabel laughed and stroked his cheek. "My poor boy," she said. "He was so brave," she explained to the squad. "All of Daddy's friends simply had to talk to him during dinner, and they're all as old and dull as him. Then all their daughters wanted to dance afterwards."
Ediard gave Boyd a helpless shrug. "This whole price of fame thing."
"Never mind," Maxen said eagerly. "It will only ever be temporary. In 10 years you'll be a fading memory, just some trivia question in a parlour game on New Year's Eve."
Ediard kissed Christabel.
"You see, my loyalty training is finally working."
She laughed and hugged him back. It was so easy, so natural. They both smiled happily at each other, perfectly at ease. Ediard knew it wouldn't be long now, and the anticipation was a soothing warmth right in his heart. Nothing like the other girls he'd taken to bed, where it was like he was in some kind of competition, nor even the cosy comfort of Jessile. Christabel and him was going to be as perfect as two people could be together.
"Here he is," Dinlay yelled.
Up on stage, Dybal ambled into view. A huge cheer went up from the audience as he waved. The rest of the band made their way on stage. Three drummers, a saxophonist, a pianist, and two more guitarists. It might have been the haze of the Jamalar oil, or the quantity of very good wine Ediard had consumed back at the party, but Dybal and his band seemed to glow in bright colours. Their clothes were truly outrageous, and for that alone Ediard joined in their rapturous greeting. The songs were fast and loud, the complete opposite of the tunes the musicians had played during the party. Lyrics spoke of love and loss, treachery and corruption, derided and mocked the council. They were angry. They were sad. Music pounded Dybal's words home. Ediard and Christabel danced wildly. They drank. He even took a drag on a couple of Kestrick pipes that were passed round. So did Christabel, her mind radiating impious delight as she inhaled. Dybal played for over an hour, long enough for Ediard to be drenched in sweat. The theatre walls were running with condensation by the time he finished his second encore.
That was fabulous, Christabel said as she hugged Edyard. I can't believe the council is still in power. Viva the revolution! She punched her fist in the air. He hugged her back and touched his nose to hers. That's your own father you're talking about.
Who cares?
She twirled around.
Thank you for bringing me.
I've been wanting to hear Dybal for a long time.
Why didn't you?
Edyard shrugged. Around them, people were heading for the steps back up to the street, all of them tired and happy. I didn't want to come alone, he said. The smile she answered with made the risk of such honesty worthwhile.
As soon as they came back out onto Doolan Lane, the squad went their various ways, calling goodnight to each other. There were very few people on the street at this late hour. Edyard buttoned up his cloak again before putting his arm around Christabel. She leant in against him, her mind showing him complete contentment. They walked back towards the pool at the end of Garden Canal, with the nebula painting pale colours against the night sky. It might have been the residue of Kestrick, but they seemed to have a lustrous sparkle as Edyard gazed up at them. Honius, particularly tonight, was beset by internal shimmering.
You often do that, Christabel said.
What?
Look at the nebulas.
Do I? I suppose I just wonder how much we really do know about them.
I can name most of them.
Ah, yes. But that's not knowing, is it? What are they really? Do you think our souls are destined to drift among them?
The lady says that's what befalls us if we don't lead a life that holds us true to ourselves.
Yeah, he said grumpily, as he thought back to those interminable Sunday mornings as a small boy at the back of Ashwell's church, with Mother Laurelin reading from the lady's scripture in a drab monotone. And who decides what true is?
Christabel just pressed harder against him, humouring the strange doubts, flecking his thoughts. His private gondola was moored at a platform on the edge of the pool, with a lamp swinging from the frame of the little canvas cabin. There wasn't much room inside. Edyard and Christabel had to snuggle up close on the bench. She pulled a fur rug up round their legs. As the gondolier set off up Garden Canal, they began to kiss. He ran his hand through her abundant hair, tasting her lips, then her cheeks, her neck, returning to her mouth. She moaned excitably, her mind enraptured. Even their thoughts seemed to merge. Eventually she pulled back, giving him the most tender smile he'd ever seen on her delicate face.
What? He asked. There was no way he could possibly have misunderstood her feelings. Few of the girls he'd known had ever been as open as Christabel.
I'm ready for this, she murmured sensually, and I know you are.
Oh, yes, he assured her.
It's just...
Your father?
No. Daddy actually approves of you. He's not quite as traditional as he comes across.
Edyard couldn't help the grin of disbelief creeping across his face. I know.
I think we both know this isn't going to be some casual affair.
Yes. There was some echo of what she said that tickled at his subconscious, which he dismissed.
So I want this to be right.
It will be.
She kissed him lightly. It's very late. We've both been partying. You have patrol duty at 7 tomorrow. None of that is good.
Okay.
I know you had a bad experience with Ranelagh, but the family has a beach lodge outside the city. It's really lovely. I would like us to go there. Just you and me, for a week.
He was incredibly sensitive to the feel of her, pressed up against him. While her whispered yearnings and the candid desire in her mind was affecting him with the same potency as any of the illicit fires Ranelagh's dominance had kindled.
Yes, he breathed harshly. Would you like that?
Yes.
His throat was so tight he could barely get the word out.
Yes, I would like that.
I don't want to pressure you into a week with me. I will go back to your maisonette with you now if you'd prefer.
No.
The beach lodge sounds wonderful.
Really?
Her cheek rubbed up against him.
Thank you.
Thank you for giving us this chance. The gondola turned along Flight Canal and headed down towards Highpool. They didn't even kiss anymore. Their faces rested against each other while they smiled.
Edyard looked straight into her eyes and mind, relishing everything he saw. The eagerness, the physical yearning, the excitement that twinned anticipation, the adoration. It was all mirrored, he knew, exactly what she could sense in his own mind. The openness was sweet. Homelt was standing on the Ziggurat Mansion's landing platform. He grinned as Christabel climbed out of the gondola.
Good morning, mistress. Did you have a nice time?
She flashed him a warm smile. Yes, thank you. A very nice time. Homelt looked down at Edyard, who tried to keep a straight face and failed dismally. He nodded briskly. Is my father still up?
No, mistress, he went to bed several hours ago. There's only myself and the night guards awake now.
I see. Well, good night, Water Walker.
Good night, mistress.
Homelt gave them a surprised look, then escorted Christabel up the wooden stairs into the mansion. Can you be ready for next Tuesday? Christabel's long talk asked. Edyard didn't even think of the mountain of work and schedules he'd have to reorganize, and a week from Tuesday was the graduation ceremony, which he could not miss. It would be tight.
I will be, whatever it takes.
I'll hold you to that. He caught one last glimpse of her atop the stairs, smiling in expectation. It was, he reflected, an enchanting smile. Maxon had been right about her beauty after all. The gondolier simply took him over to the other side of Flight Canal, where he could walk home through Silvarum into Jeevans. There were two exceptionally bored and sleepy constables standing guard on the bridge over a rival canal. Both were startled to see Edyard at that time in the morning, but he stopped for a moment to speak with them. The correct thing to do, politically, as Finnerton had drilled him, create goodwill and support at every opportunity, for you never know when you might need it. Politics, as he had learned, could never be ignored in Macathran, not at any level. It was Finnerton's clever play which had exploited the kidnapping to get the result they needed in the Grand Council following the Festival of Guidance. It was also politics which had prevented the gondoliers from going on strike as they'd threatened, for that would have made it look as if they were siding with the kidnappers. For now, the city remained on his side. He knew it wouldn't last, that there would be other attempts to subvert the council, to turn his supporters away from the exclusion warrants. In all probability, those efforts would never end. He had to remain vigilant, which he was trying his hardest to do. Christabel, though, seemed to be filling his mind these days. He thought of her when he should be concentrating on duty rotas, or meetings with district masters, or sniffing out the gang masters. He thought of her when he got up. He thought of her when he was out on patrol, remembering her laugh, the way she looked, her scent, the trivial things of which they spoke. And when he finally did get a few free hours at the end of each day and could be with her, she simply filled his whole world. Now this, they were finally to become lovers in the truest sense. When he eventually got back to his maisonette and lay on the bed, there were only a few hours until dawn when he was supposed to lead a patrol through Jeevans and round Tycho. Rather than sleeping as he should, his mind was awhirl with how to rearrange duty periods so he could spend next week away. That and how she'd felt pressed against him in the gondola. Her smile. The promise. It would be difficult for the squad to cover for him, though he no longer cared. Macathran could fall into oblivion now. He and Christabel were to be lovers. It was hard to believe. He'd never been so happy before. In one respect, Christabel and Ranelagh were very similar. Their notion of just us was one which could only ever apply to a daughter from a grand family. Admittedly, Christabel only brought three of her personal staff, not five, but the wagon which accompanied their carriage was heavily laden with luggage cases and hampers of food. And of course there was the team of coachmen and the wagon drivers, each with their own apprentices. In addition, there were the G-Wolf handlers which Homelt had assigned to them for the road. He wouldn't have minded that so much if they'd simply been able to go. But first, there were all her, rather too giggly, he felt, girlfriends they simply had to say goodbye to as they left the Culverit mansion. Poor Manartha was distraught that her sister and the Water Walker were leaving her behind, acting as if the separation was forever. So she had to be promised presents and treats on their return. He also had to shake hands with her father and swear no harm would befall his precious daughter. And that was while Lauren was watching him passively from a balcony above.
Edyard had arrived at the mansion with his one bag shortly after breakfast. The coach didn't pull out of the family stables in Tycho until just after midday. Christabel sat straight-backed on the cushioned bench opposite him, her hair woven into a broad beret, with little corkscrew curls dangling down. Simply sitting quietly, she carried herself with the kind of imperious nature that Ranelagh forever sought, yet would never be able to achieve.
"You were impatient," she said loftily. "I had to rush my leave-taking. It was almost rude. Was there some reason you wished to hurry?"
He just managed to maintain his composure.
"No, mistress."
"Really? I will enjoy testing the limit of your anticipation this evening."
"Even your cruelty is a joy, mistress."
Christabel managed to keep a straight face for another few seconds. Then she was laughing wildly.
"Oh, lady, I thought they were never going to let us get away."
She launched herself at him, and they spent the rest of the journey cuddled together. The south road out of the city was as well maintained as all the roads across the Uguru. Twice they passed militia patrols, which had recently been increased to compensate for the growing numbers of highwaymen waylaying travellers. Edyard suspected such incidents were due to the way his own exclusion campaign was squeezing the gangs out of city districts. A number of those named in the warrants had simply left. Apart from that, their trip along the coastal route was without incident. The tall palms lining the road had survived the winter, and were now shedding their scarlet fronds to make way for the new season's emerald growth. Fields on either side were being readied for summer crops, with large teams of G-monkeys preparing the vines and citrus groves and fruit gardens, while G-horses pulled heavy ploughs. This time of year always cheered Edyard up, reminding him of more carefree times during his childhood. Everyone's mood improved with the onset of spring. He hadn't known what to expect when they reached the beach lodge. Best guess was a pavilion like the one Ranelagh's family owned. He only started to suspect something different when Christabel opened the carriage windows and watched him with mischievous intent. They were no longer riding through fields. The land outside had transformed to gritty hummocks, smothered by long reedy grass with shriveled wind-bowed trees huddled in the leaves. Ahead of them the track wound down into a modest cove, with promontories of dark rock. A small stream gurgled alongside. Then he saw it, standing back from the white beach just behind the crumbling sandy bluff.
"Oh, my lady," he gasped in delight.
Christabel squeezed his hand in shared glee.
"I always loved this place," she sighed wistfully.
The lodge was a half-living sculpture. Five ancient moor oaks had been planted in a circle, then pruned and guided for decades. Their first boughs were 3 yards above the ground, woven into a platform and reinforced with sturdy planks to form a level floor. But it was the wall which fascinated Edyard. Above the floor, the trunks had been allowed to fork, then fork again. As they'd done so, master gardeners had trained them into tall arches, before bending them back towards the apex, when they'd all been twisted together into a final wall of bark and branches that opened out to shade the lodge from summer sun. It would need that shade, he realized, for the wall arches were filled with glass. A slender open deck encircled the entire lodge. The coach stopped outside, and Christabel led Edyard up the curving wooden stairs to the door, where the lodge keeper was waiting for them. The old man bowed deeply, welcoming Christabel as if she were his own family. Edyard examined the wall's thick archway pillars, marveling at the buds of green leaves that were starting to open amid the wrinkles of grey bark, seeing how the stubby twigs were meticulously pruned every autumn. In another month, the entire lodge would appear to be lead-framed panes of glass supported by lines of verdant leaves.
"It's astonishing," he said. "I didn't know people could create something like this."
He couldn't imagine anything like it in Ashwell, nor any of the towns he'd passed through on his way to the city.
280 years in the growing," the lodgekeeper said proudly. "It was my great-grandfather who originally planted the trees. Our family have tended them for the culverts ever since, and my son will take over when I pass on."
280 years to grow," Edyard repeated, impressed.
"Macathran makes us lazy," Christabel said. "It provides us with so much. We can get things right by ourselves."
Inside,
The lodge was divided up into 7 rooms by ancient wooden panelling. The central room, under the knot of trunks, was the bedroom, with a big circular bed in the middle. An ingenious array of pulleys and twine allowed slatted blinds to be opened or closed against the overhead windows. A thick slab of stone in the living room acted as a hearth for a tall brazier. It already had a fire crackling away, its smoke slithering up through an iron chimney cone. Edyard and Christabel sat on the long settee, staring out at the sea a couple of 100 yards away. He wished it were slightly later in the year, when it would be warm enough to swim. A big twin-masted trading ship sailed slowly past, en route to the ports in the south. The servants and G-monkeys bustled round, setting out their luggage while the lodge-keeper lit the iron stove in the kitchen to boil some tea. Christabel's fingers laced through Edyard's.
"Don't worry," she said dryly. "They'll all stay in the cottage behind the bluff, out of farsight range. I wouldn't want to shock them tonight. Some have been with the family for decades."
Edyard grinned, remembering Ranelagh saying more or less the same thing. He turned back to the sea. By coincidence, the Culveret family's beach lodge was only a couple of miles south of the cove where Ival's body had washed up. Edyard remembered that morning quite clearly. A week after the Festival of Guidance, he'd received the message from the coastal warden asking him to identify the body. He borrowed a terrestrial horse from the militia stables and rode out through the south gate. The sea and the rocks had not been kind to Ival. Edyard had never seen what water did to a corpse before. The bloating surprised him, as did the sallow color of the skin. Even so, there was no doubt it was the ganglord.
"Never seen anything like this," the old coastal warden said.
Edyard's farsight probed at the cords which still bound Ival's wrists and ankles. There was something appallingly elegant about the perfectly wound cords, the complicated knots, so inconsistent with the ugliness of death, especially this one. He'd counted 9 deep puncture wounds before giving up. Ival had not been allowed to die quickly or peacefully. His adversary's killing bothered Edyard a great deal more than the kidnapping did, if for no other reason than it demonstrated there was some kind of organization stirring in the city of which he had no clear understanding. Despite investigating Ival's closest lieutenants, they'd never managed to determine who'd killed him. Then again, Edyard found himself wondering about Ival's soul. Had it fled the body in the same fashion he'd sensed down in the cellar when Minartha's kidnapper had died? That souls were real disturbed him more than he cared to consciously admit. That night, Christabel banished all his doubts and concerns. The family servants might have been outside farsight range, but he was convinced they'd be woken by his cries of joy. In the morning they dressed in plain white robes and ate breakfast on the little deck which ringed the main lodge. A warm breeze swirled around them, making Christabel's wild hair sway about. After she'd finished her blue grape segments, she called her maid over to brush the tangles out and arrange it for the day. Edyard settled back as the girl began her task and told the G-chimps to clear his plates. Out to sea, 3 sets of sails were passing between the rock wings of the cove. He envied the sailors their freedom. "I'd like to do that one day," he declared. "When the gangs are no more, and the bandits have vanished back into the wilderness, we should take a ship and sail around the world."
"Nobody has ever found a way through the southern ice floes."
"Then we go north."
"Through the atolls of the August Sea?"
"Lady," Edyard, "they have reefs which stretch for hundreds of miles. The whole sea is a treacherous maze that can rip the hull off any unfortunate ship that drifts too close to the coral."
"Then we use a strong third hand to break the reef, or Farsight and G-Eagles to find a way out of the maze."
"That's my point. No one has ever really tried. We don't know what else is on this world other than bandits. What if other ships fell here on a different continent or island? What if they kept the science which built those ships?"
"Then they would have probably found us by now," she said, as her maid finished applying jeweled clips.
"Oh, yes, but still, what fun it would be to explore properly."
"I suppose it would be. I never really have time to think such things."
"I can't believe no one in Macathran has attempted to do this. The families have such money as could build the most wonderful ships.
and there are so many bored suns. Don't any of them look beyond the horizon?
Many do, but all they're looking for are girls with suitable dowries. Nobody thinks in those terms, Ediard. Not any more. The last person to attempt such a voyage was Captain Allard, and that was over 1,000 years ago. He was the Havane family's second son, who built exactly the kind of ship you talk about, the Majestic Marie. Macathran had never seen its like before, nor have we since. It was a real galleon, over 200 feet long, and had 3 masts. 80 men set sail on her, all of them experienced sailors, with the best equipment Macathran's guilds could produce. They never came back. Allard's wife went on to live past her 200th birthday. Every day she went down to the docks to ask the newly arrived ships if they'd seen her husband. The Watching Widow, they called her. They say her soul still haunts the docks even today. Ediard gave the sea another longing look. I never got to know history like that when I grew up. Not real history. It was all about who built which farmhouse or guild center, and when their families arrived in the province. Lady, it was so dull.
You poor thing.
She reached out and gripped his arm.
So where did you learn to sail?
Ediard flushed slightly. I haven't. Not yet. Christabel burst out laughing.
You can't sail, and you want to voyage around the world.
Oh, Ediard, this is why I love you so. You have such wild visions. You make it sound like anything can happen. He grinned sheepishly. I have to deal with the gangs first. Then, when I've time, I'll learn to sail.
Well, be careful of pirates.
She eyed the ships offshore suspiciously.
Our captains are reporting more sightings.
They don't pick on the larger ships yet, but small vessels have started to disappear. At least no one can blame me for that.
Why should they?
The highwaymen are mostly gang members driven out of the city by the exclusion warrants. They're very difficult to catch.
Let the town sheriffs and the militia deal with them. It's about time other people started to help deal with criminals instead of looking to Macathran to do everything for them. That's one attitude I'd like to see changed.
Ediard gave her a proud smile. The Grand Council won't know what hit it when you arrive.
And that's another thing. Why should the families practice primogeniture? In this day and age, do they think I'm not good enough?
They're fools, Ediard said promptly.
You have your ambitions, she said primly. I have mine.
Time will see us triumph.
Lady, you're even beginning to sound like Finnerton. We need to get your mind off such things.
She stood up and held a hand out.
Come on.
Ediard let her lead him down onto the sand. The grain surged round his bare feet in a pleasant, shifting sensation.
I won't ask you to do that, by the way, Christabel said. I imagine you get tired of people pestering you for it.
What? She gestured at the low waves rolling ashore.
Walk over it.
Oh, thank you. They carried on towards the sea. Christabel undid the belt holding her robe, allowing it to flow free from her shoulders. The sight of her trim body in the daylight was very arousing. She kept on walking.
Isn't it a bit cold to go swimming?
He asked lightly.
She gave him a curious frown.
Not here. The water around the city is always several degrees warmer than the rest of the sea in these parts. It's something to do with heat seeping through the bedrock, which makes the water nutrient-rich. That's why Macathran and the coastal villages have so many shellfish boats.
And of course everybody knows that, he said with rising exasperation.
Well, yes. She put her hands on her hips. It might have been intended as a taunt, but all she achieved was an extremely erotic pose as her robe fluttered behind her.
Why?
One day I would like to dump you and my squadmates into the middle of Ruland province. Then it would be my turn to laugh while you all ate poison berries and fell into dragon pits and failed to light a campfire or get your fingers stuck picking gash fungi. Just once, so you all know what it's like.
Christabel straightened her neck and sucked in her cheeks. You came to live in the city. I have no intention of ever going to live in the countryside.
Oh, really? He took a step towards her.
Dreadful place. No culture and very smelly.
She held fast for a moment as Ediard stared in outrage, then turned and ran giggling into the water.
Ediard flung his robe aside onto the sands and charged after her. Christabel was right. The water was slightly warmer than he'd been dreading. That didn't exactly make it warm enough to enjoy a good leisurely swim, but he managed to catch up and grab her. They both tumbled over into the waves, laughing exuberantly.
"This would be a good time to teach me how to make a fire outdoors," Christabel said through chattering teeth.
Ediard had given her his robe after they came out of the sea, but it didn't help warm her much. His own skin was covered in goosebumps as they walked up the sands towards the bluff.
"Very well," he said with dignity.
He reached out with his third hand and gathered broken branches and chunks of driftwood. Christabel clapped merrily as they whirled through the air and began to pile up in a hollow at the base of the bluff.
"Now, see, we need some dry leaves at the center," he explained meticulously as his third hand bunched some fragile brown gorillo leaves together. "And these trinpine spines are really useful too. They catch easily." He squatted down beside the wood to make sure the tinder was positioned just right.
Christabel knelt down beside him, her mind shielded, but wearing an expression of deadly earnest.
"So now I just need some flints."
Two suitable stones leapt up out of the sands and flew towards him.
"You have to spark them fast and direct the sparks with your third hand, so they always hit the same spot. At the same time, you stir a gentle flow of air where they hit, but not too much, because that will blow it out. Learning to use just the right amount is tricky." He twisted round to take hold of the stones with his flesh and blood hands. There was a peculiar silver glimmer of light behind him.
"Huh?"
He turned back to see the tinder burning brightly.
"Oh," Christabel cooed. "That was so impressive, Water Walker. A girl knows she'll always be provided for when you go hunter-gathering in the wild."
"How did you—"
There was a diabolical gleam in her eyes and mind. She held up her hand. Cold white flames scintillated along her fingers and arched across into the base of the wood.
"Oh."
Despite the chill, he was blushing hotly.
Christabel nearly fell over, she was laughing so hard. Her words had to be forced out.
"You are so easy to tease."
"Really?"
"Obviously."
"Darling Ediard."
She stroked his cheek.
"I'm sorry."
Then she swayed forward, unable to stop laughing.
It was no use. He couldn't stay angry with her. His petulance gave way to a rueful grin.
"Yeah, but that trick won't help you with gash fungi," he informed her.
She swarmed into his lap and twined her hands round his neck. Her smile rivaled the noonday sun.
"If I ever get attacked by legions of gash fungi, I promise in the lady's name I will do everything you tell me from that day onwards, and I'll never laugh at you again."
"Okay. Now show me how you do the fire trick."
"I'm not supposed to. The families like it kept quiet."
"Think of it as the start of the revolution."
She kissed him.
"All right."
Her mind gifted him the technique. It was actually quite simple, he thought, as he examined the knowledge. Squeezing a little stream of air and spinning it very fast at the same time to create a big static charge.
"Easy."
He lifted his arm up and let his telekinetic strength agitate the air around it. A blinding flash spat out, fanning wide to punch into the loose pile of wood. A ball of flame bloomed around the branches with a severe thud. Several flaming sticks twirled through the air, trailing smoke. Ediard and Christabel ducked.
"By the Lady, Ediard!" she exclaimed. Her mouth gaped in surprise.
The bonfire was now blazing furiously. Christabel laughed again.
"That's better," he said as the flames shot even higher. "I'm starting to warm up now."
Christabel still had her hands behind his neck. She arched her spine, falling backwards to pull him down on top of her.
"Me too."
Ediard gave the beach lodge a mildly guilty glance, then grinned lewdly.
"I always heard sex on the beach is the absolute best." His third hand unfastened her belt.
The legend, he discovered, was quite right. Sex on the beach was spectacular. As soon as the night fell on the second day, they went back to the bed in the middle of the lodge. Long after the candles had spluttered and died, Ediard lay on the bed watching the nebulas twinkle and sway across the night sky. He smiled languidly, yet sleep refused to claim him.
How far away are they?
Christabel peeked up at the ceiling.
Are you still watching the nebulas?
I don't know.
A long, long way.
Do our souls reach them without guidance from the Sky Lords?
I can't remember exactly what the lady's teachings say. I think it's difficult for souls once they've been cast adrift from their old bodies. They just sort of float away through space.
Lost. That's why we need the Sky Lords.
Yes.
She grinned and cuddled closer.
You see, you know more than I do. You must be very devout.
Hardly. I can barely remember that much.
But how did the lady know?
Because the First Lives told her, or the Sky Lords told her what the First Lives said.
I can't remember which.
Though the First Lives would know. They're the ones who created the universe. This void. The ships that brought us here came from outside.
They certainly came from somewhere else.
If they fell here from the other side of the sky, then they must have passed through the nebulas.
I suppose so.
Then they would have known exactly what they were like. Why didn't they stay there in Odin's sea? The lady says it is the doorway to the heart, where souls live forever in unity and bliss.
The ships were falling. They couldn't stay.
They fell onto Quarentia. While they are in the sky, ships fly. The people inside them control where they go, just as captains set course in our traders.
Christabel propped herself up.
He could only see the darkest outline of her, while her soft hair brushed against his chest.
Why are you asking these questions?
We have souls, Christabel. I've sensed them. When I shot Menartha's kidnapper, my farsight watched his soul take flight.
On its way to Honius, she growled.
Not if it just drifts around the sky. Ediard, she asked tentatively,
are you mocking me?
No, he promised, never. I just don't understand why the Sky Lords have abandoned us. What do we do to call them back?
The lady says we have to be true to ourselves.
Most people are, aren't they? I know so many who were. Decent, honest folk who died. Are their souls all lost? Is Akim alone and astray, somewhere in the sky? Is Melzar? Obron? For some reason he didn't want to examine. He suddenly thought of Salrana. Salrana, who was working contentiously in Ufford's hospital, waiting for the day she returned to Macathran, and him. She'd devoted her life to the lady, and she was decent. Certainly more than I am. Would her soul be lost in the void? Such thoughts made him very uncomfortable, and for more than one reason. I really ought to write to her, explain I have found Christabel. But I would never want to hear such news from a letter.
Lady. I don't know, Ediard, Christabel said, and that's the truth. If you want answers to such notions, you'll have to ask a mother. I can get you an appointment with the Pythia herself if you like. We're related, distantly.
No, I'm sorry. My thoughts are wandering tonight, that's all. He tried to put the memories of Salrana away. I'll deal with that in an honorable way when she returns.
He felt her hair shift across him. Her fingers stroked his cheek. I thought I'd managed to calm you.
You did. I am so completely exhausted my mind is in a daze. That's why I'm being so stupid.
Do you want to make love to me again?
He smiled up into the darkness where he knew her face to be. I can't actually move right now, let alone do that.
You'd better recover by tomorrow.
I'll go to sleep now, I promise. I'll be ready for you again tomorrow night.
Tomorrow morning, she said sharply.
Yes, mistress.
Christabel, he discovered, as she woke him at daybreak, wasn't joking.
During the days, they walked along the coast, exploring neighboring coves and beaches. Sometimes they'd take a swim, then warm themselves afterwards, making love in the dunes. Christabel especially took a delicious thrill at the prospect of being discovered by some estate worker or housekeeper. Obliging her wasn't exactly difficult for him. On the fourth afternoon, they walked back along the lodge's track, surveying the fields and groves that spread back from the small strip of wild ground that ran behind the shore. The coastline was a series of rugged coves, reaching almost the entire way back to the city.
Many of the larger ones were dominated by villages that had extended or adopted the curving cliffs to make harbours for their fishing fleets. The rest had been incorporated into the estates of Macathran's grand families, who had built pavilions or lodges where their younger generations could idle away the summer. Further south, the land dipped to become a saltwater swamp before rising again at the end of the Iguru. Then the Bruno Mountains stood up to fence off the arid southern plains. Towns and farmland continued to cling to the coast as it curved eastwards, all the way down to Chariao, Querencia's southernmost city, just past the equator.
"They say you have to wear long clothes all year round there," Christabel said as they stood on top of a tall hummock, gazing southwards. On the horizon they could just make out the snow-tipped peaks of the Bruno Range. "The sun is so strong it shrivels your skin, especially if you're not used to it."
"Do they have stories of anyone else sharing our world?" Ediard asked. "Perhaps strange ships that they've sighted at a distance out at sea?"
"No. Our ships trade with them all the time, and their schooners regularly make port in Macathran. If there were any stories like that, we'd hear them." She tilted her head to one side. "You're so interested in what lies beyond our reach. Why?"
"I'm just curious about the world, that's all." He didn't want to tell her his main interest was discovering where the rapid-firing guns were produced. "Doesn't it even bother you that we don't actually have a complete map of Querencia? The ships that brought Ra and the Lady must have seen what it looked like before they landed. Why didn't any survive?"
"There you go again, thinking differently. What you said makes perfect sense, but no one else ever makes that kind of connection."
"Is that so bad?"
"No, but it does mark you out. I'd love to understand why you think the way you do."
"Just the way I am, I suppose. And the things I see in my dreams."
"I wish I'd met your parents. I'm sorry if that sounds selfish, but they must have been very special people. Do you remember anything of them?"
"Very little," he sighed. "Akim told me my mother arrived in Ashwell from another province. He said she was beautiful and smart. All the men vied for her hand, but she only ever wanted my father. Actually, he'd only been there 20 years himself, so I don't suppose he counted as a local. He had a farm outside the village. It was a big place, or at least I thought so. I remember it having furniture that was very grand compared to the other houses. I don't know why. We couldn't have earned more than the other farmers. Akim said father didn't get involved very much with Ashwell. I can't say I blame him for that."
"I didn't want to stir up anything that would hurt you."
"It doesn't. They died a long time ago. I stopped grieving years ago. I hate the bandits who killed them. But Akim was a true father to me. I was lucky to know him." Christabel put her arm through his, and they made their way down the hillock.
"There are bandits everywhere," she said, "in many forms. People who prey on the bounty that others have worked hard for. The gangs are no different."
"I know. That's what angers me about them, just that they exist. And worse, that people accept their existence."
"I think our gangs are smarter than your bandits. They've managed to ingrain themselves in our lives."
"City and country again?"
"Almost. Though they seem to share the same brutality and hatred. They're broken people, Ediard. That's why they do what they do."
"Are you saying we should show them sympathy?"
"I don't know what must be done."
She stroked his face, gazing sympathetically at him.
"You do understand everyone is expecting you to provide that answer, don't you?"
"I don't have an answer. That's the Grand Council's job."
"They will blame you if no solution comes forward. Can't you hear their voices? You began this. You came to the district masters with this notion. You excluded gang members from some districts and forced them into others. Why should those districts suffer at the expense of others? What will you do to get rid of the threat you highlighted and you went to war against?"
"Oh, lady," he groaned.
"You have to find something, Ediard, some way out."
"There isn't one."
"There is at least one, and you know it. Banishment. Permanent banishment from the Crystal Walls. Exclude them from the whole city."
"That'll never happen. Master Bice won't allow that to happen in Sampaloc for a start."
"Honius, take Bice. You've got a huge political momentum growing behind you. Exclusion has been seen to work. You have to carry it forward. If you hesitate now, you'll lose that momentum.
Banishment? You're not serious.
His mind went back to the morning of the kidnapping, and how he'd been berated by Edis's wife. Where would they all go?
I can see how much this troubles you, but I think you're wrong to worry so. This is one time that imagination of yours is leading you astray. You're visualizing whole city districts being forced out at gunpoint. Edyard, the real trouble is caused by a couple of hundred people at best. I remember the night Daddy signed the exclusion warrants for Haxpen. You gave him 418. That's everybody, Edyard. Every gang member you can find. That number is nothing compared to our total population. They're so small, they're not even a minority. Get rid of the gangmasters and their lieutenants, and the rest will be lost. They'll rejoin society. They won't love you, but at least they won't be causing the kind of trouble they do today.
I suppose so. But where will the masters go? That's just giving someone else our problem.
Look, Christabel said forcefully, and held her arms out, twirling round to gesture at the entirety of the landscape. I'll make Daddy loan you the biggest ship in our fleet, and you can take them to the furthest atoll we can navigate to. Or we'll buy them 50 wagons and lead their caravan into the wilds beyond Rulan. Let them build their own houses and grow their own food. Edyard, you're not responsible for them. Not afterwards. You are a city constable, a position that was regarded with utter scorn before you arrived. You made us all feel safe again. You gave us hope. Don't falter now. Macathran cannot afford your doubts.
He stared at her in awe. She shifted round, discomfited.
What?
You are so incredible. I can't believe you even noticed someone like me.
Christabel looked at the ground. But I do.
Macathran is lucky to have you.
I won't be a figurehead for the family, a mere caretaker between Daddy and my firstborn, someone who just votes for whatever the mayor says. I will make a difference, she said fiercely.
I know you will.
Their last night in the beach lodge together was one Edyard never wanted to end. Again, when the candles had long died, Edyard sprawled over the bed, staring upwards as his thoughts slowly came together in realization. Not least, what Christabel had said to him throughout the week in so many ways, none of which had really registered before. She lay beside him now, her arm across his chest, head nuzzled into the crook of his neck, one leg over his. It was where she belonged. For eternity. I love you, he said in wonder. Edyard was dreading his return to Macathran. Some part of his brain enacted the beautiful fantasy of them staying in the beach lodge forever. It wasn't just their physical union, though Christabel was all he had ever imagined a lover could ever be. He didn't want anything to break the perfection of the week they'd spent together. I don't want to leave either, she said at breakfast on their last day.
I suppose we have to go back, he said grouchily.
We do, and don't sulk.
I wasn't sorry.
You say that too much as well.
Thanks.
I have a present for you, she said, and instructed a G-monkey to bring in one of her cases.
Edyard hadn't noticed it among all the other cases. For someone who'd spent most of the week naked or clad in wisps of silk and lace, she seemed to require a vast wardrobe. Now he leaned over with interest as she opened it, and held up the jacket inside.
A proper uniform for you, Christabel said. I can't have my man looking ordinary at the ceremony now, can I? Not on this day.
The day. Edyard took the jacket from her, admiring the cut and the seriously black fabric. It was a standard constable's dress tunic, but at the same time so much more stylish. Christabel produced some matching trousers from the case, and a white shirt, belt, tie.
Thank you so much, he said.
Then his mood dropped.
I don't have anything for you.
She gave him a strange look, almost as if he'd said something hurtful.
That's because you don't have any money. And that's good, because that's not what I'm looking for in a man.
You're wonderful.
He kissed her. We don't have time. We have to be back in the city by midday. Go and put it on.
We could spare a few minutes, he suggested hopefully.
Her finger pointed to the bedroom door, Go and put it on. Edyard did as he was told. It fitted perfectly, and as he studied himself in the mirror, he couldn't help the very self-satisfied smile splashed across his face. He did look great.
Oh, lady, Christabel murmured huskily from the doorway. There really is something about men in uniform.
The tailor got my size just right. Was he spying on me? Christabel's eyebrow raised a fraction.
I know your exact size, she purred. Now come on, we need to get going.